The Neurodivergent Woman podcast acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community.
We pay our respect to elders past, present and emerging and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. Hello, this is the Neurodivergent Woman podcast.
Hi, I'm Monique Mitchelson and I'm a clinical psychologist.
And I'm Michelle Livock, and I'm a clinical neuropsychologist.
Michelle and I met at work and bonded over a shared love of feminism and yoga.
We both saw the need to provide a free resource to adult neurodivergent women. And so the Neurodivergent Woman podcast was born.
Michelle is neurotypical.
And Monique is neurodivergent.
And we bring our clinical expertise and lived experience to the topics we explore. This is a podcast where we centre and showcase neurodivergent women from all walks of life.
Covering autism to ADHD and everything in between, we aim to educate and inspire women who think differently.
On this week's episode, I'll be speaking with Marie Cammon about stimming. Marie is a multiply neurodivergent clinical psychologist, researcher, and neurodiversity advocate. She loves animals, pop culture, music, and anything creative. So, Marie, thank you for coming on this episode. I'm really looking forward to having a chat with you about everything stimming and about your journey as a neurodivergent psychologist as well.
Thanks, Monique. I'm really excited to be here. I've been listening to the podcast for, since probably the second episode or something. It's been a long time. Whenever I do assessments, there's always a few adults who will be like, oh, I listened to the Neurodivergent Woman podcast and realized I was autistic or ADHD, and that's why they're getting assessed. So that's incredible that you guys have that kind of impact.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, this is why we do what we do, just to get the information out there for people and to try and help as many people as possible. So we're going to start off by asking, what does neurodivergence mean to you?
I guess to me it means, you know, personally being different from most people in the way that we view the world and experience everything, reality, information, sensory, you know, how we socialize, how we connect with other people. So different broadly. But I also think that for me, it means community. So to be neurodivergent for me has meant feeling a sense of belonging with other neurodivergent people, which is something that I didn't have before. Like a sense of community before I was identified.
Yeah, I love that. I think the sense of community is amazing when you can connect with other people who, you know, share your neurology and share your interests and your way of communicating. It's really life-changing. You know, I don't know if there's any research to kind of say this yet, but I really do think it improves people's mental health and like their outcomes to be connected to a community that works for you.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And I think there is some research on that, I guess more broadly about being part of a minority community is definitely protective for mental health, whether that's the case in the autistic population or just neurodivergent people, not 100% sure. But there are some papers that show that friendships between autistic people, for example, are really protective and lovely. So we're getting there.
Yeah, definitely. So tell us a bit about what it's like being a neurodivergent clinical psychologist.
Oh, I could talk about this one for a very long time. There are challenges and there are things that are fantastic, you know. So I guess the great things about being a neurodivergent psychologist are that I have a lot of feedback from my clients that they've been to many therapists before and haven't felt 100% safe, you know, to completely be themselves and to bring things to therapy that they actually need help with. They've been worried that it's not serious enough, or it might be seen as trivial, or it's really embarrassing that they struggle with that. And so they typically wouldn't bring that to therapy before, but they're bringing it to therapy now. And it means that they actually get to work on the things that they genuinely want to work on. So that has been a really great thing since I had the experience of not being out as autistic ADHD at the beginning of my career in the first couple of years. And then I made the decision to be out with my clients, and I noticed a huge difference in the amount of progress we made and in our therapeutic relationship as well. It just made such a huge difference in a really positive way. There are some difficulties as well. And, you know, Monique, feel free to chime in, I'm sure, if you want to join me, because a lot of the challenges are really to do with discrimination, I suppose. So a lot of the things that are expected of you as a therapist are based on what the majority of people do and how they operate. So we do exist in this really strange space where we have to perform to a certain degree. This role of clinical psychologist, like, I don't know how else to explain it other than to use that tone of voice, but so it's really bizarre. But at the same time, knowing that you are competent and you are doing good work, so it's exhausting. You almost have to work twice as hard to, yeah, perform this role, but then actually serve your clients in a way that works for them. So that can be really exhausting, and we do come up against some things. Like, I know plenty of colleagues who they've disclosed it in their workplace and had really negative responses from colleagues.
Yeah, I think often people are surprised, like both other psychologists, so colleagues and medical professionals, but also, you know, people in the public, they're surprised when you come out as a neurodivergent psychologist, because there is this view that, you know, to be a psychologist, you can't be autistic, you can't be ADHD, you can't have dyslexia, you can't have any form of, you know, physical disability or invisible disability as well, because it's such a hard profession to actually jump through all the hoops to get qualified. You know, you have 6 to 8 years of intense training and supervision, and you're really scrutinized through all of that to make sure you're ticking off all of the competencies. So yeah, like, I think people are often surprised when I've told them, you know, that I've been really openly autistic and ADHD. They're surprised that, you know, you can make it through the course. Then people are also surprised that you're open about it as well, because, you know, unfortunately, I think with psychology, there are a lot of positives about the profession, and there is colleagues that are supportive and things like that. But I do think psychology is actually a bit behind in terms of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And the topic of, like, yeah, being different or belonging to a minority community or being disabled as a psychologist hasn't really been talked about much. So yeah, there's definitely, I think there needs to be a lot of education within our profession and more acceptance of people working differently whilst being competent and, you know, adhering to all the ethics and standards that we need to adhere to as psychologists.
I completely agree. And you just sparked some thoughts for me as well. I think that whole idea of, like, jumping through those hoops to qualify, that's huge. I don't think people outside of psychology realize just how demanding it is to get to a position where you're registered. And for sure, I know that means that there are plenty of autistic or ADHD people who want to be psychologists who don't get there because it's inaccessible. And those of us who do get here, usually there's quite a high cost, like burnout or, you know, just chronic stress. Self-esteem. So it is a really hard road. And I do find it frustrating sometimes when you come up against these ideas of, oh, well, an autistic person or an ADHD person couldn't possibly be a psychologist. Or people start to doubt your competency when you do disclose. It's like, hang on, to get here, I have demonstrated my competency, because it is a hard road. And so, yeah, people need to remember that, I think. And then the other thing is that how you practice is completely different to real life. Going to a social event and having an unstructured conversation as an autistic person, that I do find that stressful. That is not at all what it's like to be in a therapy room where the expectations are clear. You know, it's 50 minutes and it has a structure and you have goals that you're working towards. And the dynamic is just completely different. And it's in one of my interest areas. So that how I function in that context is totally different, you know, to a social event with strangers who I've never met before.
Yeah, you know, it would be nice, I think, to get some more support from the profession in general. In psychology and in mental health professions, there's been this view in the past that you can't have mental health issues and be a psychologist. And we know that that's not true. And there's been workforce studies of psychologists showing that. And we struggle just like anybody else. And as long as you are seeking, you know, support and care for yourself and it's not impacting your practice, that's okay. And, you know, you can bring some of your lived experience actually to benefit your understanding of the people that you're working with and your role within good boundaries and ethics as well. But yeah, like often I've noticed that a lot of neurodivergent psychologists do go on to work within their communities and really bringing your lived experience to working with that particular community can be so beneficial because you bring your lived experience plus all of your professional training and expertise. But yeah, it would be nice to see some more accommodations as well for neurodivergent people going through training programs and widespread acceptance of this.
Yeah, 100%, Monique. I didn't disclose my neurotype at university. It hadn't been formally diagnosed either, but I knew I was. And I didn't disclose it because I was so scared of what that would mean for me. And I have one memory as well of being on one of my placements as a provisional psychologist, which is like your P-plates in training and in a hospital, very demanding environment. And I loved it and thrived in it. But the part I was struggling with was physically just walking around the hospital a lot. And I have POTS. So standing and walking for long periods of time means sometimes I get lightheaded. And I did mention this to my supervisor at the time, and he said, "Well, sweetie, you might want to reconsider this profession then." If that's the response I got for physical disability, I wasn't about to disclose my neurotype.
What do you mean? I mean, like the majority of time working as a psychologist, you're literally sitting down in a chair. Like working with people one-on-one, there'll be certain settings where there is more movement, but there's lots of different jobs as a psychologist where you can sit down and like, yeah, have that variability deal.
Yeah, it was just a strange, very, you know, like a generalization based on not much. So it was, yeah, a bit confronting.
And for our listeners, could you just give the full name of POTS? Because they may not be familiar with the acronym.
Yeah. All right. Let me see. Postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. Is that it?
Yes, that's it. Yeah.
So basically, it's one of many conditions that fall under dysfunction of the autonomic nervous system or dysautonomias. And it means that blood's not getting to the brain quick enough when you are standing, or especially if you go from sitting to standing or lying down to standing. So you get really lightheaded and then your heart rate increases quite drastically to try and get the blood up there. So there's other symptoms. Those are the main ones though.
Awesome. Thanks for explaining that. And if anyone is interested in learning a little bit more about POTS, I would recommend looking up POTS Australia. They have a great website and lots of information and resources for people.
POTS is more common in autistic people than the general population. And it's it's frequently misdiagnosed as panic disorder because your autonomic nervous system is what's responsible for a panic attack. So it does feel almost exactly the same.
Yeah, wow. I think that's so important for the public to hear and also other health professionals in terms of just being aware that this is something maybe to look out for when you're working with autistic clients and you're assessing for anxiety and making sure that you've ruled out any other physical health conditions as well. When did you first realize that you were neurodivergent and what was that like for you?
It was a really slow, long process with a few barriers in the way. So I didn't have like an aha moment like some people do. Mine was knowing I was different from as far back as I can remember, like very small child. I always felt different to other kids. I was always interested in different things than the other kids. And, you know, even on my first day of school, everyone kind of implicitly knew to kind of just follow the instructions of the teacher, whereas I was kind of like, I went straight to the arts and crafts section to start doing arts and crafts. And that wasn't the task we were meant to be doing. There's just a lot going on when I was younger where I was like, oh, okay, I'm different to other kids. Didn't really have a concept of how I was different. Or like any name or label. Then when I was probably 14 or 15, I came across the term Asperger's in my travels in online forums, which back then was what you have now as social media. But back then we didn't have that. And we had forums, which was literally these web pages where people would go and talk in chat rooms about specific interests. So of course I came across the word Asperger's because plenty of people in there were diagnosed. And I thought, oh, this sounds really relatable. So I think at that point I went to the library to read the DSM.
I love that. Go straight to the source.
Oh, 14 years old. Let's not ask a doctor. No, let's do some research first. Very autistic. So and what threw me was I read the criteria and I thought, gosh, that's really resonating with me. But then when I went to look it up online, I was reading a lot about a lack of empathy. And that threw me because I've always had a lot of empathy to the point where I struggle to watch the news and I don't anymore as an adult because I just get so emotionally impacted by that. And I feel, you know, like it says someone's house burnt down. Everyone's like, oh, that's sad. But for me, I'm thinking, all their photos are gone, all their memories. Like my brain doesn't switch off from going down the rabbit hole of what it must be like to be them, which is exhausting. So that really kicked the bucket down the road for a very long time for me.
Can you explain what kick the bucket down the road means? Because I don't really understand that metaphor. It's just,
delaying something.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I just hadn't heard that one before. You know, like the ones that I hear commonly, you kind of learn over time what they mean. But yeah, like when there's a new metaphor, it's sort of, I need it explained.
So it's like you're kicking it down the road and then you're going to get to the same bucket again.
Okay. I see. Thank you.
That's all right.
Awesome.
So when I was 22, that's when I went to university. So I started to, be more reading a lot more about psychology and things then. And I read the DSM-5 had just come out. It was 2013. So I was like, oh, let's have a look at this because I've always been interested in the DSM for some reason. I guess it's my special interest, but there's a lot of flaws with it. I'm not the biggest fan now, but back then I was. So I had a little read of what was then the autism spectrum. And I remember again thinking, wow, look, this really resonates. And again, went to research online. I think at that point I took the AQ and I got a really high score. But again, I just kept coming across this stuff about a lack of empathy and not being able to have friends. So I really didn't pursue anything. And it wasn't until I started working with autistic people and kids and being like, oh man, I was just like this when I was a kid, you know, and I watched a video of for ADOS training. ADOS is a test that is used sometimes to observe autistic traits in an assessment. And we watched this video of this child doing the test, and the assessor was like, oh, so as you can see, this child is not doing imaginative play, because the I think that the assessor used like a tiny little dinner plate and said, oh, look, this is a spaceship. And the girl was like, that's a dinner plate. And I thought to myself,
yeah, that's not a spaceship.
And it was probably the moment I started to actually realize, oh my goodness, like other people are watching this video and they're seeing this as a problem, but I'm watching this video and I'm like, she's playing, she's having fun, and she was clearly having fun. So I'm like, but how is this a problem? And it, yeah, from there it really kind of snowballed, and I found the online community of neurodivergent people and neurodiversity affirming therapists. And then, yeah, it was a steep learning curve from there to formal diagnosis.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it's definitely been a journey over time. But what I'm sort of hearing in terms of your story is a repeating theme of feeling like some of the diagnostic criteria didn't reflect your experiences, particularly around empathy. And I suppose that's coming to when we were both going through undergrad uni, we got taught about something called theory of mind. And that was, it was the dominant sort of theory about autistic people, that autistic people don't have empathy, and because of that, are not able to understand what neurotypical people are thinking and feeling. And I guess there was a theory, an alternate theory, that came out just over 10 years ago now by an autistic researcher called the double empathy theory. And this theory basically posited that it's not just autistic people that find neurotypical people hard to read and hard to understand, but actually neurotypical people have just as much difficulty, you know, reading social cues and understanding, you know, the emotions of autistic people. But when you're in the minority, you're the one that gets blamed or seen as having a problem. And the emphasis is on, you know, the autistic people learning neurotypical social rules.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that you brought that up, because I sit here and I say, I have a lot of empathy, but I have had feedback over my life that I come across as not having empathy. So if people are listening to this and they're kind of like, oh, well, I know plenty of autistic people and they don't have empathy, you can't be sure. You just can't, by observing someone. So what I mean by that is I feel it intensely, and I want to alleviate someone else's negative emotions if I can see that they're upset. The way I go about that, though, is maybe try to do something practical or try to share information which might be useful for them. It is not my natural urge to go, oh, that sounds so tough, and then pat them on the shoulder. Like, I, that feels really ingenuine for me, and I feel like that is almost fake and not expressing how much empathy I'm feeling. So I've learned how to do it, because as a psychologist, it's important for some people to feel heard and validated with those tools. They just don't come naturally to me.
Yeah. You know, I think this double empathy theory, it's just a, it's a different perspective, basically saying that, you know, both parties actually have difficulty understanding and reading social cues of each other. And I suppose, you know, what you're bringing up, Marie, is that people inwardly can feel that sense of empathy and sympathy, but as an autistic person, they may not show it in a neurotypical way, or they may not be able to communicate it depending on, you know, that person's preferred communication method. It may not be well translated by neurotypical people. And then, of course, there is a spectrum. You know, there may be some people who are autistic that have hyperempathy, and then there are some people who are autistic that maybe don't have as much hyperempathy as well. But, you know, what I think is problematic when it comes to neurodivergence is stereotypes, rather than seeing that every person, whether they're neurodivergent or neurotypical, is individual.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for bringing up the spectrum of empathy. I've even seen that, to be honest, in the neuromajority. Like, I've met plenty of neurotypical people who really lack empathy, and I've met plenty of neurotypical people who have empathy in abundance. So I don't think it is really based on neurotype, is my personal kind of observation of that.
Can you tell us, what are your special interests or, you know, hyperfocuses that you really enjoy spending time on?
So lucky for me and my job, psychology and neurodiversity is probably my biggest special interest. So a lot of the things that I do outside of work for fun do benefit my work. But outside of that, I've always been really so enthusiastic about art and creativity, creating anything. It's really broad. So things like collaging or drawing and painting, playing guitar, playing piano, singing, writing songs, writing poems, and then even DIY things around the house, you know, any kind of creating is something that I could just lose hours. There've been plenty of times it's been like 4 o'clock in the morning and I started something at 8 o'clock at night and it felt like an hour. And I was like, whoops, this is going to feel really bad when I have to wake up at 10. So yeah, those are the main things.
Amazing. Yeah, it's so interesting too, because I think a lot of the rhetoric around autism in particular, around special interests, it tends to be more stereotypical interests. For example, like, you know, especially with children, having an interest in trains or bus timetables or Spider-Man or Marvel comics. But yeah, for a lot of women, it can actually be an interest in people. So like specific people or an interest in, you know, the psychology, trying to understand and figure out people. But sometimes that's not assessed for because it's really focusing on more concrete interests or those more stereotypical interests.
Yeah, what I'd love to see is a movement away from the actual topic and a movement to how people engage in their interests, because I think that's really key. So even if the interest itself seems typical, you know, like a little girl is interested in animals, sure, but when I went to the zoo on a school trip, I got in trouble for correcting the zookeeper on factually inaccurate information because I was so interested in animals that I knew he was wrong.
Oh, I love that.
Even this idea, like, yes, I do know lots about animals, but then this idea that we are in an encyclopedia about our special interests, also that needs to disappear, because sometimes, yes, we are, but other times we're not, especially if you can't remember facts, if there's ADHD as well, but it's more how we engage in it. Like the fact that we will gravitate towards those interests rather than trying new things majority of the time, and how deep we get into them and how passionate we are about them. That's what's really unique, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, for me, I wasn't really interested in people until I got to high school and went, uh-oh, I need to learn to be interested in people because this is not going well. So it came out of like necessity, but then it was so fascinating that it really developed into my longest special interest. Whereas before then, I was more interested in animals, like horses and, you know, dogs and cats, and then also objects. So I loved architecture. You know, I was invited on a play date and I was more interested in the girl's dog and the architecture of her house than actually playing Barbie dolls with her, because that was not my interest.
So relatable, Monique. That's definitely, that was me as well. Yep.
So, Marie, you're doing your PhD on stimming in autistic people. Can you tell us what is stimming and what is its purpose?
Well, I would love to be able to answer that definitively from the research, but we don't have a definitive answer from the research. So how I would answer that is there's a few different definitions. So in the DSM, it's repetitive motor behaviors, so movement, and sometimes repetitive language, so things like echolalia, so repeating words or phrases or sounds. So it's that kind of repetitive behavior. And I suppose in the community, though, we talk about stimming as, yes, repetitive things, but also anything that's kind of stimulating. So I know some people talk about visual inspection, which is what the research would call it, which is when you like stare at something because it's shiny or a pretty color and you just want to kind of inspect its elements. Some people in the community call that stimming, and some people call listening to really nice sounds stimming. So I think in the community, we've got a definition of stimming that is what I view as two separate things, the movement and repetitive movement side of things and repetitive sounds, or sensory seeking behavior. And I think the community tends to combine those two. And sometimes the research combines those two as well. So I guess the answer is we don't definitely know what stimming is because there's different definitions. So in my first study, in my PhD, I've done one study is looking at reviewing the research as it exists in adults, not in kids. I did that because kids' research is mostly based on researchers observing kids or their parents and teachers answering questionnaires. And none of those things is informed by an autistic person. So I wasn't interested in knowing from that perspective. I wanted to hear from autistic people. So I looked at the research in autistic adults that directly asked them. And autistic adults report that the purpose of stimming is it is regulating. And then there tends to be three kind of areas that it can regulate. It can regulate our emotions, it can regulate our sensory experiences, and it can regulate cognition, so like boredom or paying attention. And those are the three things that come up a lot in the adult research.
Yeah, that's so interesting because I guess the focus on stimming, it sounds like in the past, and we'll talk about this more a bit later in the episode, but it sounds like there's been a lot of focus on trying to get people to suppress stimming that is maybe disruptive to others, or, you know, people are concerned that maybe their child will be bullied for stimming or experience that more minority stress because of being visibly different and attracting, you know, possible negative attention. But what you're saying with the research that's out there is that it actually helps people. It helps autistic people regulate, and we need all the help we can get because the world is stressful.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, one of the studies asked adults who had been through behavioral intervention as children and had stims, as a goal to suppress stims, and what that was like for them from their recollection of their childhood. And they said that it did a lot of damage, and being trained or conditioned to suppress their stims was mostly negative. So that was one study that I did read. And then the other thing actually that's really important to mention is, yes, some people have good intentions, like parents or doctors or therapists, where they want to suppress stims to protect the kid from bullying, and that exists. But there's a huge body of research that thinks that stimming actually has no function at all. So it's just this purposeless, random behavior that we have that serves no function, and therefore they don't think it would be harmful to reduce it because it's not serving a function. And of course, any autistic person will tell you that's absolutely inaccurate, but that has been the most leading or endorsed belief around stimming in the research until today.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that makes sense. You know, if you fall in that minority and the majority isn't doing that behavior and the majority doesn't need that behavior maybe as much to regulate themselves, from an outside perspective, it would be like, oh, well, why is that person doing that? That's so strange, or that's weird. Stop doing that, because from their point of view, like, they don't need to, therefore why should anyone else need to? And like what you're saying, particularly with children in the literature, is no one's actually asked autistic people. They've just kind of assigned a lack of meaning according to, you know, I guess the neuromajority's beliefs. And that's Unfortunately, what a lot of research in the past has been like on autism, it's really been kind of like the outside neuromajority community looking in and trying to understand and trying to study, but not actually involving autistic people in the research and not asking autistic perspectives.
Yeah, for sure. And we call that co-production now. So in the last few years, there's been a huge push in research to include autistic people in actually designing the research. So you don't just get them on board, ask for their opinion, you know, as tokenism and be like, oh, look, we did it, bye. You actually involve them in designing the research so that it's from the beginning set up in the most unbiased way possible, and we're not misperceiving the data or the measures we're using through a neurotypical lens. You're actually getting input from people who know what they're looking at because they're autistic as well. So I think we'll see large shift in research from here on since using co-production.
Yeah, and to me that makes sense. Like, it would be probably the most efficient way of getting answers is just to go directly to the source and ask people and listen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hi, it's Monique here. I have some exciting news. I teamed up with a fellow neurodivergent clinical psychologist called Jennifer Kemp to write a book. It's called The Neurodivergent Skills Workbook for Autism and ADHD. Cultivate Self-Compassion, Live Authentically, and Be Your Own Advocate by New Harbinger Publishers. It's out on the 1st of July this year, so spread the word.
Brains can get very noisy. I tend to go through phases in what's most helpful in quieting that noise and recentering. And at the moment, I've been gravitating towards music and soundscapes, slowly making my way through a huge library on the Calm app. And I've been trying to get better at having a more peaceful morning routine. And I've definitely found that the morning playlists really help a lot with that, actually.
Yeah, I think most people think of meditation as the only way we can ground ourselves and quiet our brain, but sound and music are actually so helpful. What's really cool about the music and sound library on Calm is the variety. They've got playlists for times of the day and certain moods, soundscapes, and even alpha wave and bilateral stimulation tracks, which can be incredibly effective at helping you to emotionally regulate and getting your brain in a sleep-ready state.
For sure. My favorites at the moment are the Disney soundscapes. So they've got things like An Evening in Jasmine's Garden, Merida's Mystical Scottish Forest, as well as other ones that you'd expect, like Rolling Thunderstorms and the like.
The Calm app puts the tools that you need to feel better in your back pocket. If you go to calm.com/neuro, you'll get a special offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription. And new content is added every week.
For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/neuro.
Go to calm.com/neuro for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/neuro.
I'd love to get some different examples. So you mentioned visual inspection is one type of stimming reported by the autistic community. Do you have any other examples so people can kind of see like what actually is stimming behavior?
Yeah. So it would depend on whether we're asking what is stimming in terms of repetitive behavior or what is stimming in terms of sensory seeking or stimulating behavior. So visual inspection, like looking at something for a long time because it's really nice to look at, would be more of a sensory seeking behavior. And spinning in circles would be probably more of a sensory seeking behavior if people want that vestibular input. But in terms of repetitive behaviors, the examples given in the DSM are really outdated, firstly, but also based on very small children. So they usually don't apply to adults. Some really common ones I see in adults when I'm assessing are things like tapping fingertips, which is easy to demonstrate visually, but on a podcast, I can't really do that. But it's just, if you just kind of tap your fingertips together, some people do that in some kind of sequence, or flicking their fingers. So flicking is another one. Any kind of repetitive movement with your hands or with your body, like rocking and swaying, and sometimes vocal ones, so things like popping, people pop their lips or smack their lips, roll their R's, blow bubbles, or just even repetitive sounds. So even if they're just trying to focus and they're like do 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 or something, you know, any kind of repetitive sound or movement.
Yeah. So I've actually compiled a little bit of a list in a handout that I give to clients when we're talking about stimming, just to help them maybe recognize the different types of stimming that they are doing, and then getting them to notice like what ones are effective for emotional regulation, cognitive regulation, sensory seeking, like what are their top stims that can help them regulate. So we have vocal stimming. So a little bit like what you've said, but, you know, sometimes people will hum repetitively or sing or whistle. And I know that I used to get in trouble for this in school. I would get told that I was annoying other people in the class by constantly humming, singing, whistling, tapping my pencil, tapping my fingers on the desk, you know, all of that good stuff. Sometimes people will click their tongue and count out loud. I know a lot of people will stim to auditory stimuli. So for example, listening to the same song over and over. So with Spotify, what's it called when they do that review every year of like Spotify Unlocked? Yes, Spotify Wrapped. So basically, I think I had one of the songs from the Barbie movie I'd listened to like 500 times, just over and over and over again. And, you know, it feels really good. It's really like some of these stims are really enjoyable.
Yeah, definitely. And so what you've just done there is given a great example of that overlap in the DSM criteria. And this is what I'm really interested in my PhD, is understanding, is there overlap between these things according to the community? And do we need to change the definition? Because in the DSM, for example, some of those ones like listening to a song over and over, it would classify as a ritual rather than, I guess, a repetitive behavior, because the repetitive behavior is more something you do rather than listen to or perceive. So it might be that listening to a song over and over again is more ritualistic behavior. So that's what I mean. Like, it's just really not clear. Or I suppose the community examples don't align with what the DSM has put out there. And I'm not saying the DSM is correct. It's probably more the case that the DSM has to evolve to catch up with what the actual experience of being autistic is like.
Yeah, that's so interesting, because I wouldn't perceive that as a ritual for myself. Like, it really doesn't feel like a ritual. It feels more like a stim. So it would be so interesting to ask people, you know, get them to rate their different stims and like what category that they would put it in.
Yeah. And then it comes down to this question, okay, well, maybe is stimming not like the way we define it, is it that autistic people actually define it by function? So if it's regulating, it's a stim, whereas the research is defining it by observable behavior. And so I think that's where the confusion is. If we're saying, if this thing that I'm doing regulates me, it's a stim, then that's valid. And the DSM is more categorizing them as what you would observe from the outside.
Yeah, that makes sense, you know, with what we were talking about before with outside research and then inside research. There's such a difference there. Some of the visual stimming that I've seen people really enjoy is looking at, I don't know, watching like visually stimming videos, like watching like a kaleidoscope, or, you know, those jellyfish that light up in a tank, or you can get the bubble towers. that have the bubbles that kind of shift and change, and it's mesmerizing.
I remember as a kid, like driving in the rain, like say it was a really long drive. I know most kids would be playing like on a console. Back then it would have been like a Game Boy, but I was honestly happy to watch the raindrops on the window for like hours, because they're just so interesting, the way it moves and it, yeah, and the light that refracts through the water, and there's just so much to look at.
Yeah, that's so true. I think that's where people also like, you know, the ooze tubes, or those little toys that you flip and it has the liquid bubbles that kind of move and spin. So I remember whenever I went into my boss's office, she would have these ooze tubes. And when I was having supervision, I would always grab it and be like watching it during supervision. And before I got diagnosed, I'm pretty sure she knew that I was autistic, because that is an area that she specializes in, is autism in girls and women. And after my diagnosis, I told her and I asked her, yeah, like what her thoughts were. And she was like, yup. And yeah, she kind of pointed out how I'd always be drawn to the sensory stimuli during our supervisions. And I guess that's maybe not a neurotypical way of doing supervision.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And I think, you know, there are still times in my life now where I have to engage with other people outside of our community in meetings and things. And I do notice a huge, huge, huge difference in what it feels like in my body to have to sit in a meeting without fidgets or sensory stimuli. It's incredibly uncomfortable. And I can't believe in those moments, I'm like, I can't believe I did this for 30 years before making changes in my life to accommodate myself. Like, I'm 34 now, it's been 4 years that I've been adjusting my life, but for 30 years I did this. I, you know, felt incredibly physically uncomfortable. Like, how exhausting.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think it's really nice seeing like conferences in recent years, like the Yellow Ladybugs conference in Melbourne. And Yellow Ladybugs is an organization focusing on autistic girls and gender diverse people. And at their conference, they had like little lollies and chips and STEM toys on every table in the conference. So it really normalized, because there was a majority of autistic people attending, but there are also, you know, teachers and health professionals who may not be autistic, but it was normalizing fidgeting and stimming during, you know, the whole day that you have to, well, not actually, you didn't even have to sit. There were bean bags. There was a breakout room you could go to. You could move around at the back of the conference. Yeah, it was wonderful.
Yeah, I remember that was the first, I think it was 2021 maybe, or 22 was my first Yellow Ladybugs conference. And I went there and I saw the fidgets on the table and I saw beanbags and I saw people kind of pacing up and down the sides. And I went to the bathroom and the hand dryers had been turned off. And that was the first time in my life that I realized I actually felt relaxed to go to the bathroom. And I hadn't realized before that I never feel relaxed in a bathroom, because I'm just waiting for that hand dryer to go off at the most random time that you can't predict. And it's too overwhelming. So yeah, I remember I have a really strong memory of my first Yellow Ladybugs conference and being really emotional about how much of a difference those things made for me. And I had an experience last year where I did some training online, and it was a 2-day training that I needed to do for my job. And it was probably the first training I've attended that had nothing to do with neurodiversity in like 3 years. So that was a really humbling moment, because, you know, we got we log in to Zoom. It was on Zoom, and they were like, okay, so here are the rules for the next 2 days. Your cameras must be on at all times. You must not leave your computer. Designated eating times. And I just panicked. Like, I really had to take a few minutes to regulate myself, because it was daunting, the idea of 9 to 5, 2 days in a row, of having to do that. If you're allowed to have your cameras off, that's okay, because I can briefly turn it off and stim or pace or rock and do these things that other people for sure would think are weird if they saw it on Zoom. So that pressure of having to have my camera on meant, oh my God, I'm going to have to stim under the table or find a way to regulate myself. Yeah, it's been a long time since I've experienced something like that, and it really humbled me again. And I was like, oh gosh, I need to keep this in mind as well, that lots of my clients, this is every day for them in their workplace or university.
Okay, so some of the other stims that I've kind of seen people do are people like waving their hand in front of their face and kind of watching it, watching a stim toy, like we've talked about, like the ooze tubes, watching light dance on the walls. And, you know, I've seen a lot of people that love those light projectors that kind of make patterns on the walls, watching an hourglass, love hourglasses. They are amazing. And yeah, basically just watching anything that's repetitive or sensory stimulating in a pleasing way.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Actually, as you said, the thing about the hourglass, I just remember that whenever we went to visit other people, I was raised in the strong Italian culture, so lots of visiting other people, and a lot of their homes had things in them like sand artwork or hourglasses, and I would just always gravitate towards those things rather than sitting at the table and chatting, which I also did. But my initial instinct whenever entering the homes was, oh, I'm going to go look at that sand thing that they have that like you tip it and it's colored sand and it moves, and I just loved that stuff as a kid.
Oh, that sounds amazing. Yeah. And honestly, I think as a kid, definitely sitting under the table was better than sitting at the table. I really do think that's a neurodivergent thing. Like, I've asked so many people and they're like, yes, I love sitting in my cupboard or under the bed or under the table or dark, small place. It's not for everyone, but yeah, it's a theme.
If I'm in control of it, like an MRI and I have a meltdown, legitimately, I've had one before and they had to reschedule me and give me something to sedate me because I just melted down of the claustrophobia and the noise. But when I'm in control of the situation, like as a kid, I used to go in my wardrobe all the time. I would get, because we had those roller door ones, built-in ones. So I would go in there and just shut the roller door and just sit in there in the dark and for a little bit. And then I'd be fully recharged and come out hyperactive as ever. So yeah, that's, and sitting under tables, there's a story Mum tells me of one time she lost me in, I think, Target or Kmart because I went into a clothes rack.
Yes, they were the bomb. Love being in the inside the clothes racks. It's a whole nother world in there. Oh, so good. So yeah, some of the physical stims that I've observed people doing are things like twirling their hair or playing with their hair repetitively, tapping, you know, tapping your fists together, rubbing clothing between your fingers, chewing on clothing, chewing on jewelry, fidgeting with jewelry. There are some people that will kind of apply pressure to themselves. So squeezing, you know, maybe their arms or their legs. For people who kind of learn to mask their stimming, often they'll kind of take bigger, more visible stims and do stims that are less visible. So I remember in high school and uni doing things like squeezing my toes inside my shoes in a pattern and actually squeezing like my leg muscles and my calf muscles in a pattern rather than jiggling my leg or tapping my fingers. And I've been jiggling my leg like this whole interview because that is one of my go-tos.
In the middle of an assessment once, a client just stopped their sentence and was like, are you ADHD? And I was like, I was not prepared for that. And being autistic, I'm just not inclined to lie. If I'm put on the spot, I can't do that. So I was like, yeah, I am. Why do you ask? And he goes, oh, because it was via telehealth. And he's like, well, I can just see that something is moving. And I'm assuming you're like shaking your leg under the table.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's definitely, I'm very hyperactive, which is, it's wild to me that nobody picked up ADHD as a kid, because I'm not that internalized type of ADHD. I'm very restless. And I do struggle to sit still for even 10 minutes at a time. So I'm always moving my legs or something.
Yeah, absolutely. Another hidden stim that I think can be common is actually even clicking your teeth together in a pattern, like moving your tongue around. Sometimes things like, you know, classic things like hand flapping and tiptoe walking. But yeah, there's so much more than I think some of those really classic ones. Things like actually dancing or jumping up and down on the spot, like what you've mentioned, the swaying and the rocking. And yeah, the spinning, that's so interesting. My husband constantly spins in a circle, no matter where we are, in the shopping center, in the airport, just sort of spinning. And I remember that we were on holiday to the Northern Territory in amidst COVID and things like that. So that was stressful. And we were waiting in this long line to get like our COVID pass checked and all of that. So my husband starts spinning in the line and he starts doing all these dance moves and dancing and just fidgeting and all these stretches. And it was hilarious because, yeah, he's like this cis, like half Chinese guy doing all these ballroom dancing moves and spinning around in this line full of FIFO workers that are very kind of typically Aussie males. And we were getting so many looks and stares. And it is something that I actually worry about when we're traveling overseas as well. Like if you have suspicious or odd behavior in an airport, that can be really a struggle because you're worried about maybe, I don't know, getting pulled for questioning or something like that. But yeah, he just is completely not self-conscious and doesn't care. And he's regulating himself. And I think that's really cool.
I think that's really cool too. I used to, speaking of feeling unsafe, I used to get, as a teenager, I would often get security come up to me in shopping centers. And looking back, it, you know, I definitely didn't make eye contact and I was stimming all the time. So to someone who doesn't know what an autistic person unmasked looks like, they might think that I was, shifty or on drugs. So that was an experience of mine. And I remember always feeling so confused about why I kept getting security coming up to me. And now obviously as an adult, I know why. And I try to minimize that in airports as much as I can. And having the sunflower lanyard though for invisible disability has really helped with that. Now I feel a bit more safe to stim if I need to, because I've got that lanyard which identifies me as having a disability. So I think that maybe takes away some of the judgment, I hope, but so far so good.
Yeah, I mean, it can be a really valid security concern in terms of worry for your own safety sometimes. Yeah. And then I think just some last ones are people will sometimes repetitively crack their knuckles or, you know, pop different joints in their body and sometimes blink or clear their throat. Yeah. Basically anything repetitive that's to do with autism and that's not a tick from Tourette's as well. Part of getting assessed and, you know, talking about people's repetitive behaviors is looking at, well, what is that actually coming from? Is it autism? Is it something else? And we do have an episode on the podcast, I believe from season 3, where we talk about repetitive behaviors and we talk about OCD, tics and Tourette's. So there is a little bit more clarity. If you're wondering, you know, go and listen to that episode. But yeah, they're just some examples of common stims. There'll be others. This is by no means a comprehensive list, but we just want listeners to, have a think about some of these different stims that Marie and I have both talked about, you know, for your own self-knowledge and maybe for learning about someone that you love or someone that you're working with to help normalize these and go, oh, they're just regulating themselves rather than, oh, what a weirdo.
Yeah, I'll just add on hand flapping. which is probably one of the most stereotypical ones that we think of, is, you know, a small child flapping their hands in the air when they're excited or dysregulated in another way. I would have sworn that I have never done that in my life. You know, I was just, oh, no, I've never flapped my hands. I've never, ever. And then a few years ago, my partner at the time knows how excited I get about animals. He found it pretty adorable. So he decided to film, I guess, my joy at meeting some animals at a community farm. And there's video footage of me, and it blew my mind, of me walking up to a horse and being so overcome with joy that I was flapping my hands. And I had no, like, I didn't even pick that up. It was just so innate. It was just what my body did that I didn't even register that that's what I was doing until I watched this footage back. And I was like, oh, my gosh, what am I doing? And he's like, that's what you do when you're excited. Didn't you know? So, yeah. We can be unaware of our stims, I guess, is the point there.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, often I think because it's just something you do, you know, or if you grow up in a neurodivergent family, everyone is doing it. And sometimes it's not until you go to school or you get maybe feedback from other people that you realize that you're doing something different.
Yeah, that's a really important point about the type of family that you've grown up in. My mom was just naturally really affirming, had no idea that we were neurodivergent, but just intuitively knew what to do. So I never, ever heard anything come out of my mom's mouth that was like, don't do that in front of people, that's weird, or don't do this, that's going to annoy people. She never said anything like that to me. But I know from my clients that so many people have grown up with parents, whether they're autistic or not, that internalized ableism, they've raised these kids and my clients to be really aware of how they're presenting outside of the home. And I'm really glad I've had a lot of challenges in my life, but that was not one of them. My mom just let me be myself, which was beautiful. But yeah, it does. It makes a huge difference, I think, especially in stimming. If I'm assessing adults who had that kind of parenting where they had to suppress it, they really struggle to answer this question. And so what we end up doing is I try to observe it rather than get them to report it, because they don't actually think they stim or even know that they stim.
Okay, so I think we talked a little bit about some of the changes in the rhetoric and the research about stimming and autism. But yeah, can you just run us through what is the evolution that you've seen in research about stimming and autism?
So I mentioned before that stimming has largely been viewed as not having any purpose or serving any function. So that's definitely the majority of the research that exists in this area, kind of, or in autism, I guess, does put these behaviors down to being purposeless and not serving a function. Then you've got it moving from that into kind of, okay, now these behaviors are a problem. So we need to develop intervention to reduce stimming or repetitive behaviors. And that's largely been where it that's where the research has been. And then I would say maybe in the last 5 years, we've got a movement now more towards neurodiversity affirming view of stimming. So we've got, for starters, we've got more papers that research studies that have interviewed adults and looked at their experiences. We've got, I think, just a couple of studies that have been co-produced with autistic people. So it's looking like the research is very much going to evolve into acknowledging that stimming does have a really important function for autistic people. So having said that, though, you know, we exist in this bubble of neurodiversity, right, where so much of the research that we're reading and the people that we know in this area are affirming, but there is still a really large group of research and researchers and clinicians and, you know, doctors who do still strongly believe that stimming is a problem that needs addressing. So we're not anywhere near out of the woods, I would say, when it comes to that. But certainly we've now got a small body of research that's going to be really challenging that view. So that's good.
Yeah, I guess with the seeing stimming as a problem, you know, we've talked about people being concerned about people being judged or bullied for stimming. But what I've kind of seen in, I don't know, sort of people that I've interacted with and parents is also a concern about stimming taking up too much of the person's time so that they're not kind of paying attention in school or they're stimming rather than maybe socializing in a neurotypical way. But I think, you know, if we're having some research that's kind of actually looking at, well, stimming is helping the person to regulate, then, you know, maybe this will help people understand that, you know, the more time that someone is taking out of their day to stim, maybe the more stressed out they are by their environments. And, you know, we know for anyone, regardless of neurotype, that if you're really stressed and in fight or flight mode, socializing isn't probably going to be a priority. Actually, self-regulation is going to be a priority.
Yeah, it comes down to like basic human needs, right? I come back to this all of the time, especially when working with kids where there are teachers or pediatricians or OTs or like whoever else is involved who don't have an affirming view. I approach it from a stance of logic and I try to appeal to their logic. So I try to present it as you're expecting a child to do something that is much higher up the pyramid of needs or the hierarchy of human needs than the basics. They don't have the basics. They don't feel safe. They are stressed. They haven't slept well. They're not eating enough. And you're expecting them to learn in a classroom with 25 other children or 30 other children in it. Learning is absolutely not a priority if you are in fight or flight. Like your priority is homeostasis, like get back to where your body and nervous system are meant to be for baseline functioning. That's the priority. And that's just a fact of biology. We can't access our brain to learn and do those higher order things if our basics aren't there. So yeah, it is a good point. And I like that you've pointed that out because I think a lot of interventions have focused on reducing stimming and even in classrooms, you know, like this concept of whole body listening or quiet hands is presented as the way that is going to help children learn, but it's not if they need to move to learn. So then it becomes this issue of, well, if you want the behavior gone, that's one thing, but if you want the child to learn, that's another thing, and you have to pick one. We can get rid of the behavior and they're not going to learn because they're going to be dysregulated, or they can learn if we let them stim and regulate. You can't have both. You can't make a child stop stimming and expect them to learn.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, important that we talk about this and that people learn about this choice, because I think in the past, it really has been more focused on behavior and behaviorism rather than focusing on emotions and regulation and being trauma-informed. Just a trigger warning, we are going to talk about self-harming behaviors in a moment. So for anybody who needs to switch off or pause, please do that now. So Marie, can you talk us through about, you know, what if someone is stimming and it's actually causing harm to themselves? So for example, there are some autistic people who will headbang when they are distressed, and it will be to the point of potentially giving themselves a concussion. That's just one example when stimming causes physical harm to the self or people around them. Can you talk through what are the harm reduction approaches, you know, that it's good to be aware of when that's happening?
This is a really great question because stimming, obviously, it's not always positive. Like, it can cause harm to yourself or to other people. I guess the answer is it really depends on the person and on the situation. The way that I tackle this in my clinical practice really is different client to client because it depends on a few things. Now, some of the things I would consider is when are they doing those stims? So most of the time, not always, but most of the time, if a stim is harming someone, it's because it's not a stim that they do regularly, like every day. It's one they do when they've reached a level of distress that is unbearable. So if that's the case, which it is for most people, what I usually look at is how do we prevent them even getting to that level of dysregulated in the first place? So usually that will mean looking at the environment, looking at the stresses in the environment, trying to minimize and accommodate wherever we can. And then you see a reduction in their overall level of distress and how severe their distress gets. And then, of course, they won't engage in that stim. But then you need a plan because that could take a while to get them to a place where they're not that distressed. So you need a contingency plan. What do you do when they're going to engage in this stim? And that's going to look like something alternative that meets the need that's not as harmful. So we're not trying to take it away because it's serving a purpose, but we need to give another regulation tool that's going to help. And that will differ person to person. So one example I know is some people, if they get to a level of distress, quite a high level of distress, will pick at their skin or fingers until they bleed and get really sore. So we look at what's something else you could do, like painting some non-toxic glue onto your finger and peeling that off. Or is there something else there that we can come up with? The headbanging one is tricky because there's not many safe things that replace that. With something like that, where someone's genuinely at risk of really seriously harming themselves, I try to come up with a collaborative plan. So if they're a kid, even if they're an adult, get their parent or their partner or their housemate to come in, and all together we come up with a plan on what to do when that happens. And that might look like preemptive consent for the other person to like squeeze them. So I don't like the word restraint because we're definitely not putting someone on the ground and putting body weight on them. It's very dangerous. But something like, you know, holding their arms so they can't reach their face if they're going to scratch themselves or can't hit their head against a wall. So yeah, those are just a few approaches we could take, prevent them getting there in the first place, and then alternatives if they do get there.
Yeah, I think, you know, talking through this is really important because it is, I agree, I've seen people do stimming that becomes harmful to themselves or others basically when they've hit meltdown. And it's really working with the person on other self-regulation strategies or, you know, looking at the function. So if they like a particular type of input, like sensory input that the stimming's giving them, it's sort of looking at, well, are there alternative ways you can get that input without causing as much harm? And that's basically what harm reduction is, you know. In psychology, we use harm reduction with all types of things. So sometimes it will be with things like drug and alcohol services. Sometimes it will be an addiction. Sometimes it will be, you know, around things like self-harm. But it's, yeah, trying to find a replacement behavior or strategy that meets the underlying need for self-regulation that's causing less harm.
Yeah, that's a great point. Sometimes OTs can be really helpful here in assessing what the sensory input is that the person needs and giving some ideas around it. Mm-hmm. I've found that too. Yeah, so if someone's head banging, for example, it might be that they really need the proprioceptive input, which is your awareness of where your body is in space. So hitting your head or hitting your arms or anything like that is giving your brain information. Oh, yeah, my body is here. This is where my body ends and air begins, which sounds really odd if you've never experienced that being out of whack. But when that's out of whack, it feels incredibly strange. A lot of people can panic about that sensation. So, you know, something like resistance bands that you can just get from Kmart, you know, that are people use for like yoga or Pilates, that can give proprioceptive input. So could we try something like that where people are pulling on that or pushing against a wall or pushing heavy items, something that's giving the same kind of feedback?
So, Marie, what strengths has neurodivergence given you? And do you have a favorite moment or story that shows us how your brain works?
So, I think overall, my favorite story is just my life trajectory. So, to encapsulate that really in a nutshell, I did not cope with how school was structured. And I was a really high achieving student in primary school and even in year 7 and 8. Year 9 is where I really started to struggle academically with unsupported ADHD and also socially. I've always been a bit more autistic dominant in social relationships, I suppose, but it got really hard in year 9 going to an all girls school. So the way you socialize completely changes at around that age. Dynamics got really complex. I found that really stressful. I was being bullied pretty badly all throughout, even in primary school. So I did really struggle there with my mental health and with my performance at school. And then I didn't even finish high school because I hit burnout. I had an episode of ARFID so severe that I ended up in the emergency department. So I couldn't finish year 12, had to drop out. And then it took me a few years to recover from the trauma of that experience. I've had a lot of medical trauma in my experience of hospital, including restraint and some other things I won't describe here. So plus I was burnt out. So it was like 3 or 4 years or something before I ended up deciding I did want to go to university and do that. And in that time, all I did was recover for a few years there. And then, you know, in my 20s, I was trying to live this life that you're supposed to live in your 20s. Like I tried being really social and going to bars and social events and having large groups of friends. And boyfriends and whatever. And I just really struggled with that. And my mental health did not get any better. So my favorite part of this whole story is that when I tried to go to school and I tried to live this life after school, everything that you're supposed to do by society standards, that's when I functioned the worst. It's when my mental health was the worst. It's when I really didn't have much success in anything that I tried. And the real turning point for me in my life was when I accepted that I was autistic and when I got medication for ADHD. And I started to really think radically, like, what works for me actually? What do I need? And what happened then was everything got so much easier, and I've been successful at the things that I've tried because I'm doing them in the way that makes sense to my brain. And that's when I've thrived, really, truly. What has been hard is the social feedback. Since making that change in my life and honoring my needs, I get a lot more rejection. I get a lot more negative feedback, and I get a lot of people that have a lot to say about how I'm not doing it right. So that is hard. That's a hard thing to navigate. But for me, the benefit far outweighs it.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your personal story. You know, I think hearing that trajectory and hearing, you know, what you've been through in terms of trying to adhere to neurotypical and neuronormative expectations, and then what has actually worked for you, I think will be helpful for others listening. So to finish up, do you have any top tips for others?
Top tips for others, I think, is honoring your needs. And some people might think, okay, Marie, that sounds great, but I don't know what my needs are. So it really starts with listening to your body. And if you struggle with that, you could even just start reflecting on a week at a time, you know? So even if you just download one of those apps that lets you track your mood every day and write notes in it, or just use your notes app or use an actual notepad with a pen and just write down like how you felt that day in the language that makes sense to you. So if that's, I felt bad or I felt, you know, then write that. It doesn't have to be the language that you think other people need to understand. Only you have to understand it. And have a look at if you start to notice any patterns, you know, is it on the days where you're in a work environment that, you know, you feel really stressed, or you notice that you're, I don't know, maybe the skin around your fingers is particularly wrecked on those days because you've been picking at them. See if you can notice any patterns and start to address it from that angle, I guess. Okay, so on these days I'm feeling this way, how can I reduce that, or what can I put in place there? Maybe I need more alone time. Maybe I need more time without masking. Maybe I should ask the workplace if they're okay with me working from home 2 days a week or 3 days a week or whatever it is. So it's really thinking about it from that perspective and meeting your own needs. I think that's the biggest one. We can't really thrive, no matter how desperately you might want to be neurotypical, for those of you that are still struggling with accepting that you're neurodivergent, no matter how bad you want it, it's just not going to happen. You're never going to be neurotypical. So start getting to a place where you have well-being and you're flourishing. Start with getting to know and understand and meeting your needs.
Amazing. Thank you, Marie. So if you are interested in learning more about Marie's work, she has her website, www.mariecarmen.com, where you can check out all of what she's doing. And Marie also makes stickers. So you're welcome to check those out, and you can buy Neurodivergent Pride stickers. And Marie is on Instagram at Marie Carmen. If you enjoyed this episode and want to support us further, you can do so by subscribing to our Patreon. To become part of our Patreon community, you can buy us a coffee for $5 per month or a wine for $10 per month.
All of our Patreon subscribers receive access to a backlog of exclusive content, to basic text transcripts from season 4 onwards, and to a monthly live Zoom hangout with us and our Patreon community. Our Zoom hangouts are a place to ask questions, chat about your experiences, and connect with other neurodivergent women.
Patreons shouting us to a monthly wine get all that, plus one exclusive content post per month. We really appreciate your support as we aim to make quality mental health information accessible to everyone.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurodivergent Woman podcast.
If you have a question or would like to contact us, you can do so through our Facebook and Instagram at the handle The Neurodivergent Woman Podcast, or our website, ndwomanpod.com. You can also email us directly at ndwomanpod@gmail.com. Bye for now.